Well, when Eric initially sent out the request to come and speak, I said, no way. And then I don't know what got into me, but I'm like, sure, I'll do it. And I blindly chose Rahab. I had no idea who she was, what she was about. But studying her, her story is really dynamic, and I am glad that I had the opportunity to kind of dive into who she is. I much rather would have a textbook in front of me, a teacher manual, speaking to my special education high school students than in front of a group of adults, but I'm here. And so...
Do you want to use this?
Sure.
This is the bottom button.
The story of Rahab is we're introduced to her in Joshua 2. She shelters and she makes a deal with some spies. And then she's saved and she's in the genealogy of Jesus. So in Joshua 2, verse 1, it says, and Joshua, the son of Nun, sent out of Shittim two men to spy secretly, saying, go view the land, even Jericho. And they went and they came to a harlot's house named Rahab, and they lodged there. So here we have Joshua going into the promised land and fulfilling God's commandment. He sent out these two spies, and they came to her house. And doing some research, some people think that her house was in the wall of the city of Jericho. So that's the first encounter. You know, you kind of come to this house of Rahab, who is a prostitute. So what eventually happens is word gets out to the king that there's some people coming into the city of Jericho, some spies, and he sends some of his men to kind of go and investigate what's going on. And Rahab hides the men, and she lies to the king's, the king's men. And she kind of hurries off the king's men, and she kind of infiltrates this whole thing. Let me just go to the next slide. If you look in the blue, this is really important because Rahab, while she's hiding the men, she kind of has faith in God, and she says, for the Lord your God, he is God in heaven above and on earth beneath. And now please swear to me by the Lord, since I have shown you kindness, that you will also show kindness to my father's household, and give me a pledge of truth and faithfulness. And so she's asking she's asking for herself and her father and her mother and her whole family to kind of be spared. And so she steps out in faith. And I think this is really important because she didn't have any knowledge of Jesus other than what when the people came, you know, the stories of the time and what people were saying. And so she wasn't a Bible scholar. But here it shows that she kind of steps out in faith. And the Israelites... agreed, and they said that if you hang this red rope in the window when we come back to destroy the city, to take over, to conquer it, that we will save your family and then whoever is inside of the house. The other thing that I thought was kind of interesting is Rahab being, her profession being a prostitute, she must have had a lot of shame and guilt that comes along with being, you know, in that profession, even though it kind of was normal where she was in her life. But I still think that when you have shame and guilt, you don't feel worthy. And she had that faith, and she acted upon it regardless of the shame and the guilt. So the story ends where Joshua eventually captures the city, and he fulfills the promise to Rahab, and her family is saved. So here's kind of what I thought about the whole story. First is that it's all about him. She welcomes all. When I first thought about Rahab, it means broad or wide. And so I first thought, oh, she welcomed all into, you know, her home, into this inn. And then I started to think, but it wasn't about Rahab, it was about him. And it was about his broad love for us. It was about his broad love for Rahab. And I think that sometimes we get caught up in our own little world and we're very egocentric. And I just feel that we need to wrap ourselves in what delights God. And it's not about us, it's about him. We don't need to try to keep up with the Joneses. When we're in the midst of a crisis, it's not about what I, you know, I think when we're in the midst of crisis, our tendency is to kind of maybe feel despair and destruction. But if we have faith and that's our first step and our first go-to, I think it kind of propels us a little bit further. The other thing that I thought was really important is that usually in the Bible, when Rahab is mentioned, her occupation is mentioned as well. And here you have Rahab, a prostitute, who is in the direct lineage of Jesus. She relocated. She met Salmon. They married. And when we think of a prostitute, we think of somebody that's a throwaway, that's maybe worthless. But Jesus didn't see her that way. Okay, he saw her as his child. It's a little bit counterintuitive for us, I think. But if we have his perspective, that's when transformation begins to take place. When I don't see myself as the world sees myself, as me, when I see myself as God sees me, then transformation can kind of propel us and move us forward. So that was really important. And then lastly, faith and action. In James 2, it says, in the same way was not even Rahab the prostitute considered righteous for what she did when she gave lodging to the spies and sent them on in different directions. As the body without the spirit is dead, so is faith without deeds is dead. So faith and action kind of go hand in hand. Rahab had the talk and she had the walk. She took the spies in, she lied to them, she sent them out, and then further she kind of hung that cord in her window. When I was thinking about the destruction of the city when the Israelites were taking it over and the crash, you know, the crashing and the crumbling and all the chaos that was kind of surrounding her, she could have chosen to run. She could have chosen, you know, not to stay and to have faith. I'm sure she was afraid. She didn't know what to do, and she probably had negative thoughts. But she, again, had faith and the action to stay regardless of what was happening around her. God fulfilled her promise to Rahab. And then at the end, I was trying to kind of sum everything up. And it was later on, I've been kind of reading and rereading for a couple weeks now. And this really simple thought came to mind. And I don't know, sometimes simple is just better. And the thought was that no matter how far I am away from the cross, what direction I'm going in, it's simple to just do a 180, turn around, and then focus on the cross again. Thank you. That's it.
I'm going to finish writing that last little bit down.
Water.
Thank you, Dietra. Thank you. I know that, you know, one of the best things about this series for me has been hearing the perspectives of y'all ladies and just what the Lord's speaking to you. And I don't know. You said something in there that I'm probably going to come back to in a little bit, but you said that transformation occurs when we see ourselves as God sees us. And sometimes, a lot of times, we think that transformation occurs when we get with shame or with guilt, or with just kind of all this negative pressure. But when we begin to see ourselves and know our identity as God sees us, that's when transformation occurs. One of the key pieces of this passage about Rahab is that she is a prostitute. And every time her name is mentioned in the scriptures, except maybe, I don't think that it's mentioned here in Matthew and the lineage, but when she's mentioned in Hebrews, we'll go talk about that in a little bit. She's also mentioned in James, as Dietra pointed out, as she's mentioned in the book of Joshua. This label, or this name prostitute, is attached to her, harlot, lady of the night. And so there is in that, one of the things that I was kind of thinking about this week was, as we think about a prostitute in the Old Testament, that kind of concept can be very far from us. We can think that it happens back then, or that it happens not here in our kind of circle in Orange County. It probably happens somewhere up in the seedy parts of Los Angeles or in the big cities, but we don't think that happens here where we are. And so as I was thinking about it, Robin and I got invited about a month ago, 6 weeks ago, to a dinner put on by an organization called Redeeming Love. And what Redeeming Love does is Redeeming Love is actively working to fight the sex trafficking problem that's happening right here in Orange County. So prostitution and sex trafficking is a serious problem right here in the most perfect place in the world, right? We think about Orange County, we just think about Newport, we Disneyland, and all the good things about it. But there is this kind of seedy underside where sex trafficking and prostitution is happening. And so Lauren invited us to this, and Lauren has taken a role in this organization. And I thought to myself, I said, it would be a great morning for us as a church to at least consider some of these things about prostitution and about sex trafficking and how that affects what we're about as a church as well. So I don't know if I've given a proper introduction, but I think I've gotten us pretty close to where, I don't want to say too much, Lauren, because I know you have so much to say. So would you all welcome Lauren to come up here, and then she's going to share a little bit about sex trafficking in Orange County and Redeeming Love. And do you want to use this too?
Sure.
So it's just the bottom one.
Okay. So this is a really heavy topic. It's not something that's very easy to talk about. And so first, I feel like I just need to say as a disclaimer that I want to tread prayerfully on this subject. I think in our world today, like one of the shadows of our world becoming smaller is that we hear about every issue that there is, you know, like we're so aware of what's happening globally and even locally, and it just can be really overwhelming and cause us, I feel like more times than not, to just freeze or become desensitized or whatever it is. And in no way do I think, I mean, we each can only tackle so much in our lives, and especially, you know, those of us I think of with families and responsibilities. And so I want to go into this just saying that I don't expect everybody to feel like called to this. But I know for me personally, it was a big moment when I heard about what was happening locally with this, because it's always something, for many years now, it's been something that's like been in my heart and on my heart, but I pushed it pretty far back for a while because all that I knew about it was more internationally or larger organizations maybe working more on the East Coast or on this national or global level, but I didn't know about what the problem was locally and also if there was anything I could do locally. And so when you don't know about those ways to help, I feel like that's when it can be feel more debilitating than inspiring or motivating. And so even though I hesitate sometimes to talk about it because I don't want to put too much burden or load on people who are already doing great things and working towards other causes, I also know that for me personally, if this would have been going on and no one would have told me about it, I would have been disappointed because it was something that was on my heart, but I didn't know what to do about it. So I was thinking about Rahab, the way that we think of a prostitute or the way that we think of this story as, I feel like when prostitutes are mentioned in the Bible, a lot of the focus in my focus is on like the fact that God used this person and redeemed them and that they were in this life of sin and then that God is still able to use us even when we're in these lives, living lives of sin. And as I've learned more about prostitution and what we've sometimes viewed as a lifestyle choice, or a profession or occupation. I started to think a little bit differently about this story. Even the way that God used Rahab, maybe it was more of a, what if some of these stories are more of God flipping these social and political strongholds in society, instead of it being God used this prostitute. What if God's saying, like, this is wrong, this wasn't your fault, this God's empowering her to step out in, like Dietra mentioned, step out in dignity and in confidence to these spies, when you would normally not think that someone in this lifestyle would have dignity and the self-worth to even do that, but God's strengthening her despite what's been done to her. And I think so. And the mention of her being in Jesus's genealogy, even being showing us in some ways that, like, our lack of knowledge about who she was and her character, and maybe, like I said, flipping those social and cultural and political norms on its head. If that makes sense. Modern day prostitutes, and we think of, like, Julia Roberts. I think of her right away, right? Pretty Woman. The way that she's viewed as maybe a little down and out, but choosing this profession and then kind of being saved by a man. So even if a prostitute didn't choose the lifestyle, I feel like often we think of it as, well, she was really down and out and needed money, and this was her only option. When the reality is that almost no one in the sex worker industry is entering by choice. And these are new findings and new developments that come out more and more about the lack of choice in this field. So that leads us to human trafficking, which is defined as the act of recruiting, harboring, transporting, providing, or obtaining a person for compelled labor or commercial sex acts through the use of force, fraud, or coercion. And this is truly our modern day slavery. And I think for a long time I knew about this happening internationally, but the amount that it's happening in our country and in our state and in our county is pretty overwhelming. And so it's divided up into often labor trafficking and sex trafficking. So labor, let me see if I have. So labor trafficking, oftentimes being agricultural, domestic servitude, nannies, housekeepers, and that sort of thing, small businesses, nail salons, sales crews, people selling magazines and that kind of thing. And then sex trafficking often happening, bars and clubs, so strip clubs, obviously, residential brothels, so places that look like normal houses that are actually brothels, escort services, commercial front brothels, like the jokes about the massage parlors and that kind of thing that is actually happening. And then more and more is online advertising becoming a part of this. So a lot more online. This is the second largest criminal industry in the world, and it's rapidly growing. It's a $32 billion a year industry. So these victims of trafficking, the age of entry is between the most common, the average age of entry is between 12 and 14 years old. Often there's been a history of trauma and abuse, so a factor, a common denominator for a lot of these people is being in a vulnerable life situation already. And where in the past it was thought that a lot of people were brought, a lot of these modern-day slaves were brought from internationally, it's being researched more, it's being shown that most of the ones in the U.S. are actually from the U.S. And oftentimes, like if you read this quote, oftentimes it's someone that they know already or are introduced to in some parts of the world, in some parts of our country. It's even a family member in dire straits and selling daughters or whatever it is. In the situation of this quote, was a boyfriend or someone she thought was her boyfriend. So you can imagine the type of vulnerable girl who would actually believe someone was her boyfriend that was leading her to do this, right? Pretty awful. So the bottom, 30% of shelter youth, 70% of street youth are victims of its commercial sexual exploitation of children. So kids on the streets are really vulnerable to this. California has about double the rates of any other state for sex trafficking in particular. I mean, it's a big state, so that's a part of it. But Orange County, when you think of Orange County and the wealth that we have here, that also goes for the sex industry, unfortunately. So it's known to be, when they've talked, when like the district attorney in human trafficking that spoke at our event that Eric was referring to, when he spoke of talking to and interviewing pimps, this is like a hot spot for sex trafficking because they know they can come here. So a lot of people coming here from out of state or different counties because they know they can get top dollar for their girls here and that people pay a lot more here. So it's actually happening rampantly in this area. And it was shocking. I didn't know either before the DA spoke at our gala that we had in May about the different locations that this is taking place. I mean, he showed pictures of like a apartment building that looked like a nice apartment building in Irvine. And was like, this is a brothel, actually. A lot of these rooms are being used as brothels, and you would never know it from the outside. I think we've known for a while, Denny used to, when we lived in Huntington Beach, he would drive up beach to go to work at Servite. And what's that intersection that's real bad? It's like beach and...
It's in Stanton.
Yeah, and you know, that's like an obvious area of it. And you would think that that's where it's mostly taking place, but more and more, it's just everywhere. I think a quote that one thing that the DA said that night was to burn your computers for all of you with children, especially young daughters, because like I said, more and more it's happening online, and not even, so like I said, often like a common denominator is for youth who are in really vulnerable situations or maybe have a history of abuse, but more and more it's happening to just normal teenagers who are vulnerable simply because they're a teenager and get lured in on Facebook or different ways. And like I said, I don't want this to be just fear mongering, but that it's just to be aware that it's happening. So this is a little bit about Orange County in particular. About half of the victims here are minors. Okay, so one thing that's really lacking right now in Orange County is places for girls to go, which is, Eric mentioned Redeeming Love already, which is what Redeeming Love is, a gap that they're hoping to fill. There is currently one shelter that's specific for survivors of sex trafficking. So there are other shelters and places for girls to go, but that might not have specific care for this sort of abuse and situation, which really needs to be heavy on the trauma-informed therapy and wraparound care in all different sorts of areas. And currently there's one that I think has 5 beds. And the irony is that when I asked, we were asking the DA of what they're doing now, like if they prosecute a pimp or someone who has control of these girls and they are getting the girls out, Where do they do? If they want to stay out, what do they do with them? And the answer was often they put them up in hotels or motels, which is sometimes where they just came from. Obviously a different motel, but it's sort of an ironic situation that there's just nowhere to go. Partly because this is new. A lot of this is new that we're realizing what the decriminalization of prostitution and realizing the deep roots and causes of it is new. So this is a little bit about what we can do. There's needs to be, like it says up here, a collaboration of all different areas of our community with law enforcement and the government and community members, awareness of what it looks like. I had the opportunity a couple months ago or so to travel to Chicago with a friend, with a gal who's spearheading the Redeeming Love Orange County house, and we visited a Salvation Army house that's serving survivors of sex trafficking, and they've, for this area of work, they've been around a long time, which is really only about 10 years or 11 years, but they've been doing a really great job, and the founder of that house, his main job is going around just raising awareness. So he goes to hotels, to like transportation services, like people who drive buses and that sort of thing, to schools, to law enforcement, to all sorts of different government agencies and community services and schools and all of that, just to let people know what's going on, because the more awareness that there is and the more that people know about it, the more people know what to look for and know when they see it. So that's a big part of this. And then also places for survivors to go. We need places for them to be. So Eric mentioned Redeeming Love. They're based in Covina, and they just opened up a house in that area on July 5th. And so their situation right now is that they're going to be giving long-term care for adults. So they can't receive, there's a lot of laws surrounding minors. And so their first project is for, I think it's 18 to 24-year-old women. And they'll have 12 to 18 months of care, and that'll include trauma-informed therapy, different vocational workshops, education, substance abuse counseling. So really trying to be holistic in the care that they're given there, and also kept really busy. That's been something that we've heard time and time again, to be able to have a successful house, is to keep the girls busy and doing things so that they don't just drop out and want to go back, which is a major risk factor. The rate of recidivism is really, really high because of what a deep-rooted problem it is, and the DA, another thing the DA said is that one of his first times of interacting with one of the girls that he rescued, he walked in and expected her to be giving him a big hug and thanking him, and she had some choice words for him that wasn't exactly what he was expecting. Basically, like, I don't owe you any thanks. Like, what do you do? I want to go back. What are you doing? You're not saving me. So this isn't something that's simple or easy, an easy problem to solve. And in no way is this going to just make it easy. Having these services and having this house, it doesn't mean that all these girls are saved and it's done. They'll have a long, long journey, even once they make the decision to get out and stay out. And I think we go into this knowing that it's kind of like working in a church, or working with, like, being a high school teacher, of knowing that you're, like, planting seeds and you might not see the results of that anytime soon, if ever, but knowing that you're doing something along the way. So as far as Orange County Redeeming Love, it's like a separate chapter. We want to open up a house here in Orange County. Our goal is in a couple years to have a house here. And right now we're really trying to just build relationships in the community with the Orange County Task Force, especially trying to get in. The Orange County Task Force is one of the major, like, players in this movement, and they're a collaboration of law enforcement, victim service providers, nonprofits, faith-based organizations, and they have awareness events, and they just all work together to provide services and care for girls or boys coming out of this. So we are basically, like, at the very beginning of this journey of trying to do this. We're setting up a board right now. We just had our first event in May, which was a gala, and already working on that again for next year. I hope sometime in the next couple of years to put on a 5K to raise some funds also. And looking for people who are interested, either have a strong passion for this cause, or have different things that they might be able to provide to help with this. So other ways to learn or volunteer, there's within the OC Task Force, there's volunteer opportunities. And I mentioned one other house in Orange County that's providing long-term care for survivors, and it's called Lighthouse, and it's with the Orangewood Foundation. And the second Monday of every month, they have forums talking about sex trafficking and what's going on locally and what you can do. I've yet to go to one of those, and I'm looking forward to being involved in that also. I'm going through a training right now that's called Hands That Heal, and it's like an online program that's very well known to learn more about this and how to learn more about how to serve survivors of sex trafficking and help in their healing. And then, like I said, Redeeming Love, I mean, of course, that's near and dear to my heart right now, and we're not even sure, like I mentioned, opening up a house in 2 years, we're not sure yet about what that will look like. We're trying to really be willing to be flexible in what the community needs, whether it's a emergency shelter, so somewhere to go right when girls get out, or whether it's a long-term care facility, that will depend. Hi! That will depend on what the people in Orange County who are really knowledgeable about this, about what they also what they think is needed and where the gaps lie. So I also just wanted to end. I mean, like I said at the beginning, I know that in terms of actually volunteering with Redeeming Love or getting involved in fighting against sex trafficking in Orange County is not going to be something that everybody can do. I am very aware of that and aware of all, like, even as I look out all the different cool things that people are already involved in. But it's such a deep-rooted problem in our culture, and there's so many different things that you can see that lead to this, and this being so rampant. And one of those, I mean, a huge, huge issue is pornography. And for a long time, I feel like it's been focused on as this personal moral problem, an issue. And it's been talked about a lot, but maybe not enough in terms of its implications, its broader implications, and maybe not enough in terms of who are even the girls that you're seeing when you look at porn. Maybe how many of those people are trafficked individuals. And like it says up there, 70% of women trafficked are being shuffled into the commercial sex industry. So like porn, strip clubs, and all of that sort of thing. And then also like pornography being a lot of young men's sex education today, and that leads to such desensitization towards violence towards women, towards prostitution. And then we didn't talk much about slave labor or labor trafficking, and I don't want to, because that'd be really too much and overwhelming. But one quick thing I can say, just that there are so many ways to combat against these things without volunteering for an organization or being directly involved, and just our power as individuals of what we purchase, like I said, of the way that we behave in terms of what we buy and what we look at and what we do, and of course pornography being one of those. And another one is the way that we buy. I mean, in Orange County we can buy most anything we want anytime and without much knowledge about where it comes from or who had a part in making it. We're really, there's a large gap between where it's produced and how it's produced and us as consumers, and that slave labor is also like a really rampant problem. And so one solution to that is knowing where your clothes come from or where your products you buy come from. So all of these things, if you're interested in more info, that's it for now.
Thank you. Okay. That's quite a bit to think about. And I just felt that as we look at this, this woman, Rahab, just gives us a really good kind of entry point to at least be able to start this conversation, at least be able to like say, hey, let's think about this. And again, it's not a problem that's, again, in Southeast Asia where we think about, or in Los Angeles, but the issue that it is happening here in our neighborhood, and there are things that we can do about it. And so I don't know how the Lord might have spoke to you through that, but again, I just think that I want our church to be aware of that. I want our church to be in prayer about that. If the Lord has spoke to you to volunteer or to give something or to do something for Redeeming Love or to make that connection with Lauren, or let me go back to some of these things here to learn or volunteer. That Hands That Heal, if you want to scribble any of these things down. What's the website, by the way, for Redeeming? Is it redeeminglove.com?
It's redeeminglove.ca.com.
Redeeminglove.ca.com if you want to look more into that organization. Let's do this. What I want to do is I want to end. I want us to, I just want to read that narrative of Rahab so we can kind of have a real good picture of who she was and how that all went down. And then I might make one point at the end, but we'll see how long it takes us. Maybe I'll just say one thing. Because, Dietra, you said something that was really key, and I want to jump back to that at the very end. So if you got a Bible, let's go to, we're going to go to Joshua chapter 2. Going to read this narrative together. Again, I think one of the things that the Lord's kind of spoken to me and just kind of shared with me about this is let's just familiarize ourselves with the stories of these women, of Sarah and Rachel and Leah, and obviously we're going to get to Rahab this morning. And because sometimes we think about these Old Testament, we're like, that's kind of vague and fuzzy, but So really just to kind of have a grasp of who this woman was and what she did. So the narrative kind of begins, and as Dietra mentioned, the narrative kind of begins here. So this is Israel's exodus from Egypt and entry into Canaan. So again, Moses kind of leads the people up until about number 16, 15 or 16 right up there, where Moses and Aaron and Miriam, as we talked about last week, they all pass away. And so now this guy, Joshua, has taken the mantle of leadership, and so he's kind of in charge. And they're about to make their entryway, again, this land of Canaan, the land that was promised to Abraham, the land flowing with milk and honey. They're about to make their kind of conquest into this land, just a beautiful land. So they're going to make their entry point into the city called Jericho. And so Joshua, in verse 1, he's the son of Nun, secretly sent two spies from Shittim. Go look over the land, he said, especially Jericho. So he sends these spies, and he said, I don't know where all these spies go. But again, they probably go kind of cruising around in here. He said, but I really want you to check in on this city, Jericho. So they went, and then they entered the house of a prostitute named Rahab. And they stayed there. When I was doing this study at one of the books I was reading, this question kind of popped up. And here's the book, and then it says, why do you think the spies chose Rahab's house for lodging? I just kind of chuckled to myself, be like, a likely answer, because if you're thinking, well, there's two young men and they go to a prostitute's house, like, first off, that seems a little fishy. But the likely answer here at this point is that maybe they, for the most part, I would imagine that if you're going to a brothel or to see a prostitute, that you'd want to remain anonymous. You wouldn't want people to know who you were. So perhaps these two young men, as they go into this city called Jericho, they enter this brothel, and their goal is just to remain anonymous. They just are spies. They're trying to see what's going on in this land, and they want to remain anonymous. So somehow, they don't remain anonymous, because in verse 2, the king of Jericho was told, look, some of the Israelites have come here tonight to spy out the land. So the king of Jericho sent this message to Rahab. Hey, bring the men who came to you and entered your house, because they have come to spy out the whole land. But the woman had taken the two men and hidden them. She said, yes, the men came to me, but I did not know where they had come from. At dusk, when it was time to close the city gate, the men left. I don't know which way they went. Go after them quickly. You may catch up with them. But she had taken them up to the roof and hidden them under the stalks of flax she had laid out on the roof. So the men, the king's men, right, they set out in pursuit of the spies on the road that leads to the fords of the Jordan. As soon as the pursuers had gone out, the gate was shut. So that, you know, obviously Rahab isn't honest with the king here. She says, no, there were some men here. I didn't know who they were. And then she says, hey, go chase them that way. And so the guys go to chase. And then in verse 8, before the spies had laid down for the night, she went up to the roof and said to them, I know that the Lord has given you, I know that the Lord has given this land to you, and that a great fear of you has fallen on us, so that all who live in this country are melting in fear because of you. We have heard how the Lord dried up the water of the Red Sea for you when you came out of Egypt, and what you did to Sihon and Og, the two kings of the Amorites east of the Jordan, whom you completely destroyed. When we heard of it, our hearts melted, and everyone's courage failed because of you, for the Lord your God is God in heaven above and on earth below. Now, real quick, this, what she does is she tells a, she's using what's called, I'm looking for these slides because they're all out of order now. This is the, it's called a concentric structure of Hebrew poetry, and I don't know how much this is going to speak to you this week. Maybe you'll just be meditating on concentric structures. But what she does here, and this is kind of the way that Hebrews would kind of use their poetry, the top matches with the bottom, the second matches with that one. So she says, I know the Lord your God is God. So if you look at this poem that she says here, and then he, right, is a great fear, melting in fear, and then this part is our hearts are melted and our courage failed. And then in the middle, it says we have heard. So she's heard about what's going on in the desert. There is an absolute swarm of human beings coming up through the desert, and she knows what's going on here. She sees the writing on the wall. She's obviously, she's a pretty smart woman, we could say that, right? So she cuts a deal with these guys. Verse 12, now then, here's the deal. Please swear to me by the Lord that you will show kindness to my family because I have shown kindness to you. Give me a sure sign that you will spare the lives of my father and my mother, my brothers and sisters, and all who belong to them, and that you will save us from death. So she makes a deal with these guys. And the guys say, okay, our lives for your lives, the men assured her. If you don't tell what we are doing, we will treat you kindly and faithfully when the Lord gives us this land. So she let them down by a rope through the window, for the house she lived in was part of the city wall. Now she had said to them, go to the hills, so the pursuers will not find you. Hide yourselves there 3 days until they return, and then go on their way. The men said to her, this oath you made us swear will not be binding on us, unless when we enter the land, you have tied the scarlet cord in the window through which you let us down. And unless you have brought your father and your mother and your brothers and all your family into your house, if anyone goes outside of your house into the street, his blood will be on his own head. We will not be responsible. As for anyone who is in the house with you, his blood will be on his own head if a hand is laid on him. But if you tell what we are doing, we will be released from the oath you made us swear. So they got the deal, and they use this red cord as the sign. And obviously this red cord kind of above the window is a shadow, or it's an image of the blood on the doorpost in the Exodus. It's a shadow or an image of the blood that covers the new covenant. So she says, use this cord, they say, use this cord, and we will not get everybody in your house, and we'll leave that room alone. And so agreed, she replied, let it be as you say. So she sent them away, and they departed. And she tied the scarlet cord in the window. When they left, they went into the hills and stayed there 3 days until the pursuers had searched all along the road and returned without finding them. Then the two men started back. They went down out of the hills, forded the river, and came to Joshua, son of Nun, and told him everything that had happened to them. They said to Joshua, the Lord has surely given the whole land into our hands, all because the people are melting in fear because of us. Now let's just go to chapter 6 and we'll see how the story ends. And we'll start in verse 22. The great scene of them marching around the city with their trumpets, blowing their trumpets, the walls of Jericho. I'm sure you sang songs about this as a kid. Joshua says to the men in verse 22, who had spied out the land, go into the prostitute's house and bring her out, and all who, again, notice how they refer to her, and all who belong to her in accordance with your oath to her. So the young men who had done the spying went in and brought out Rahab, her father and mother and brothers, and all who belonged to her. They brought out her entire family and put them in a place outside the camp of Israel. Then they burned the whole city and everything in it. But they put the silver and gold and the articles of bronze and iron into the treasury of the Lord's house. But Joshua spared Rahab the prostitute with her family and all who belonged to her, because she had hid the men Joshua had sent as spies to Jericho. And she lives among the Israelites to this day. So this woman, Rahab, again, we kind of get the narrative of her and how she hides the men and she makes this deal with the men. And she's end up saves not only herself, but saves her entire family. But I think just the one thing that I'll say to this, and I'll skip a ton of stuff here. But let me see here. I want to talk about her first name, her middle name, and her last name. In the book of James, you see, Dietrich, you referred to this verse here, James 2:25, in the same way, not even Rahab the prostitute. Again, notice how often this label is attached to her, right? Why not just say Rahab here, right? Scriptures keep attaching this label, Rahab the prostitute. If you go to the book of Hebrews, in Hebrews 11:31, this says, by an act of faith. Now, this is the hall of faith here. This is the Moses and the King David and the Abrahams. This is all the important people in the scriptures. And she is in this hall of faith, right? By an act of faith, Rahab, the Jericho harlot, welcomed the spies and escaped the destruction that came on those who refused to trust God. So when I think about this with Rahab, I think there's the one thing that I kind of wanted to say about this was that she has a first name, a middle name, and a last name. And here's what I mean by that. The first name that each one of us have is that you are created in the image of God. This is the name that you get, right? You are good. You are beautiful. You are loved. You have the divine image, the divine spark reflecting and shining in you. God has literally breathed into you. This is Genesis 1. This is where the story starts, right? Is that humanity was born, and we were born with a divine image. We were born with a divine spark. We were created in the image of God. We're good, and we're beautiful. And this is the first name, I think, that we are given by our Creator, right? Now we have a middle name, right? We have, I would say, the Genesis 3, our fall, right? You have a flaw. You have pain. You have your hurt, your disobedience, all the ways you've come up short. You disappoint yourself. You lash out at others, sin, the hurdles you face day in and day out. So you have your first name, which is, you know, that you are created, that you're beautiful. But then we have Genesis 3 here where we fall, where we're broken, where we're hurting, right? And we face this day in and day out. Sometimes what we hear in Christian circles is we start with our middle name. And people want to tell you how rotten and how flawed and how disobedient you are and how much of a sinful person you are. But if you put your middle name before your first name, you miss the story that the Bible is trying to tell about you, right? So you have your first name, how beautiful you are. You're created in the image of God. You have your middle name. You have your sin. You have your fall. You have your faults. And then you have your last name, right? And your last name is that you, even despite your flaws, your faults, your sin, your mistakes, that you are adopted, that you are an heir in the kingdom, that you are redeemed, that God has purchased you despite all of your mistakes, right? The obviously redeeming love, right? That you have been purchased by Christ. Dietrich, you shared about doing the 180 and looking at the cross. And when you look at the cross and you realize that Jesus paid for you despite your middle name, right? That he reconciled you to Christ, and you have a brand new identity in Jesus. So I would say with Rahab, you could look at it like this. So you have Rahab, and that's her first name, and she was somebody's little girl. She was born, and somebody held her in her arms and said how wonderful and how beautiful and how loving she was, and she was a little child running around, and people praised her, and people were so happy with her. And then at some point, what I thought you said, Lauren, is no little girl grows up dreaming about being a prostitute, right? Women are often forced into this or often coerced into this. This is a last resort for women. I don't think that Rahab was like, oh man, I can't wait to grow up and be ravaged by men for money. But then Hebrews gives her a new last name. They call her Rahab, and they acknowledge her middle name. But Hebrews says, but she's faithful. She's trusting. She's obedient, right? Again, in James, we see that James, you know, says her name's Rahab. Again, that's her first name. Her middle name is prostitute. They don't ignore that. But then James says that she's justified, that she's righteous, that she's approved by God, that she's freed, that she's vindicated, right? You could do this with your name. Here's Eric's name. Eric, you could say, here I am, Eric. I'm a little boy, and my parents loved me, and they said so many wonderful things about me. And I understand my middle name, too, that I'm a sinner, that I get angry. One of the things we talked about with the love series is the irritability, how irritable I can be, how controlling I can be, how lusting I can be, how fearful I can be. I understand my middle name. But this isn't the last name that has been given to me. The last name that has been given to me is that I am a son of the Most High God, that I'm a saint, that I'm free, that I have been washed clean, that I'm God's masterpiece, that I have been made whole, that I am forgiven. And so with Rahab, we see these three names, and with us, we see the same three names. Now, I want to ask you this. What would you say would be your first and your middle and your last name? And I've given these out before, and I'm going to give them out again because I just think that they're so important. Fans are increasing as.
It's been warm.
Oh, it's been warm. I would like you just to take a moment, and again, I don't know. Just take like a couple minutes here, and then we'll play a song or two. But again, we have a first name, and maybe you just want to write down your first name, and then you want to write down your middle name, and you want to just kind of name out your flaws, your mistakes, the things that haunt you, your sins. And then you just look over this list, and you look over your identity in Christ, who you are in Christ. And Dietrich, you said, where did my notes go?
Right here.
Dietrich, you said this, and I wrote this down, that transformation occurs when we see ourselves as God sees us. You need to know who you are. You need to know the last name that God has written about you. And so just take a moment, and whether it's on that little sheet or you grab out a notepad and you do this, but let's just take a little moment to do this, to write down your first name. Hey, who am I? What is my flaws? And now what does God say about me in light of those flaws? Does that make sense? Anybody got any questions?